This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. It sounds like an explosion, but it's actually an underwater recording of a seismic air gun. They can be heard more than 1,000 miles from the source, and it's known to impact marine mammals. The question is, does it affect fish? Seismic surveying is a process used to map the geologic structure of the seafloor to find oil and natural gas deposits. It's also used to determine the best location to install offshore renewable energy infrastructure and where to extract sand for beach nourishment. The method has drawn criticism from environmentalists and conservationists concerned the pulses, compared to the intensity of exploding dynamite, can negatively impact sea life. Associate professor at the Duke Marine Lab in Beaufort, Douglas Nowichak.
We do know from several studies that what we see in some of the toothed whales, or the echolocators, so the sperm whales, pilot whales, sperm whales for sure, from some experiments in the Gulf of Mexico, they reduce their feeding rate when exposed to seismic surveys.
Past studies have focused on how seismic testing affects whales and other marine mammals' ability to communicate, hunt for food, and reproduce. However, little is known on how fish species are affected until now. Marine ecologist and PhD candidate at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences, Avery Paxton, was the lead author of a 2-year study observing how fish respond to seismic testing.
And in the fall of 2014, I was studying reefs off of our coast when we had a really rare opportunity. A seismic survey was going to be conducted off our coastline near this reef I was studying, and we were able to monitor it.
In September 2014, a vessel with the U.S. Geological Survey was mapping the seafloor to understand earthquake potential off our coast. Usually seismic testing occurs in deep water, but this survey was going to occur about 30 miles out of Beaufort Inlet at a site known as 210 Rock. The tropical-looking reefs are composed of a natural rocky hard bottom about 6 feet high and submerged in about 100 feet of water. Federally designated as essential fish habitat, colorful corals, sponges, and other invertebrates cover the surface.
This particular reef is a fabulous place for fish to call their home. The fish use it for a nursery ground. They also use it as a place where they forage. They eat lots of plants and animals that are associated with or growing on the reef. And they also use the reef likely as places to reproduce and just to live, to escape from predators.
3 days before seismic testing began, divers placed underwater microphones called hydrophones, as well as video cameras to record sounds and what fish on the reefs were doing. A hydrophone was placed less than a half a mile away from the closest approach of the surveying vessel's path on a natural rocky reef, another hydrophone 4 miles away on an artificial reef, and a GoPro video camera about 5 miles away on a natural reef. Since divers aren't allowed in the water during the survey, the camera was set up to record 10-second videos every 20 minutes, the hydrophones capturing continuous audio. This is the reef before seismic surveying, the sound of fish and shrimp feeding. Paxton and a team of researchers with the Duke Marine Lab and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Ocean Service were able to use the information collected at the reef to count and identify fish.
3 days before the seismic survey, the fish exhibited a pattern that was repeated. And that pattern was that during the morning and early afternoon hours, the number of fish stayed about constant. And then during the evening, their numbers peaked up into about 300 fish.
Paxton calls the congregation of fish happy hour.
And so what happened on the day when the seismic noises were present is that the abundance was lower throughout the day and never peaked in the evening hour.
With cameras rolling and audio recording as seismic testing started, Paxton says they observed many of the fish leave the area. Reef abundance declined by 78%.
What was really interesting about this decrease is that it happened during the evening hours, when before the seismic survey was in the area, the fish were most abundant on the reef. So, phrased another way, 4 out of every 5 fish were no longer accounted for on the reef.
According to the study, seismic blasts recorded by the hydrophone less than a half a mile from the surveying area exceeded 170 decibels. In comparison, 150 decibels is the noise level of a jet taking off at 25 meters away. In humans, exposure at this level can cause eardrum rupture and permanent hearing loss. Dr. Jill Lewandowski is the Environmental Assessment Chief in the Office of Environmental Programs, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. After reviewing the report submitted to BOEM, she says the method in which the levels were recorded at the reef site were very basic, arguing more advanced techniques would be preferred.
You know, not all microphones are created alike. So I would say the same is for hydrophones. You have to have, you have to very carefully determine for the purposes of what you're doing, which kinds of hydrophones you use, how they're placed in your study site, what methods after that you're using to interpret your data.
Dr. Lewandowski has read the report and watched the videos that show how the fish vacate the reef during seismic testing.
There clearly is a response by the fish. The problem or the challenge we have is mostly in a study you would want a lot of you would want more than one sample size. So this is sort of one point in time, and you would want to have a good before, during, and after amount of data so you understood what was happening before, what was happening during, and what happened afterwards.
Due to an equipment malfunction, marine ecologist and lead author of the study, Avery Paxton, says they weren't able to document if and when the fish returned to the reefs.
We don't know the duration of this decrease in fish and how long it lasted. We suspect that the fish came back to the reef probably pretty quickly, but we don't, again, know what time scale that was on. We think that the fish likely hid in nooks and crannies on the reef or moved from the noisy reef to a nearby quieter reef.
Despite the absence of this data, Paxton says the study provides evidence of a significant reduction in fish due to seismic testing, representing a disruption to daily pattern. This, she says, means further studies are needed to understand where the fish are going, how long they leave a particular area, and why they leave in such high numbers. Dr. Lewandowski.
I think in this instance, we have a snapshot of something, and what we really need is more information to sort of fill that picture out.
BOEM will continue to work with their partners, including the Institute of Marine Sciences, Duke Marine Lab, and NOAA's National Ocean Service. She cites an upcoming survey with NOAA that seeks to better understand auditory thresholds for commercially important fish, such as black sea bass. BOEM has funded more than $50 million in surveys, including Paxton's study, to explore the impacts sound has on marine mammals, sea turtles, fish, and invertebrates. Currently, there are no authorized airgun surveys in the Atlantic Ocean due to a decision by the Obama administration. However, that could change. You can see pictures of these underwater reef sites, videos captured from GoPro cameras, as well as listen to audio from the hydrophones at our website, www.publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Individuals struggling with sickle cell disease may be on the cusp of a breakthrough after an international year-long drug trial ended last year. One of the most active test areas was in eastern North Carolina. Chris Thomas has this.
Majara Mooring of Greenville, like millions around the globe, live with a disease that causes hidden, though intense, pain.
Because it could be to the point where I can't walk. And one time I just told myself, look, just cut my limb off. I would feel better. If you cut it off, the pain would go away.
Mooring was diagnosed with sickle cell disease as an infant. It causes blood cells to harden and take on the form of its namesake. Blood clots are common, and it can shorten the average lifespan by decades. Mooring said hospital visits have been common throughout her life.
Starting out with it, I was hospitalized, I can say, every other month. I was in there on my birthdays, every holiday. It was to the point where I have a twin brother that doesn't have the sickle cell disease, but he has a trait. But it was to the point where they will also have a bed for him in my hospital room.
Last year, she and 197 other sickle cell patients from three countries participated in a trial for a new intravenous treatment called crisanlizumab. The trial was sponsored by Celexis Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Darla Lyles at the Brody School of Medicine helped facilitate the Greenville leg of the crisanlizumab trial, which included 11 local patients, Mooring among them. Lyles also oversees a Greenville sickle cell day clinic that treats 750 patients from across the region.
In the 1990s, there was a large study performed with hydroxyurea. And hydroxyurea is presently the only medicine that the FDA has approved that really alters the number of crises that people have with sickle cell. And so we try to put all of our patients on hydroxyurea. The problem is it's not an easy medicine always to take.
Hydroxyurea comes in pill form, and Lyle says patients have to take it multiple times a day over a long period of time for it to work.
It's not something that automatically makes a difference, that you can't see the difference in a week or a month. It takes 6 months or a year for it to alter the types of red cells that are being made by your body. And so patients are sitting there taking it every day and seeing really no benefit.
Research on the disease has been sparse, in part because it impacts relatively few people, about 100,000 people within the United States. It's inherited and found primarily in individuals with sub-Saharan African, Caribbean, South and Central American ancestry. According to the CDC, one in 365 black children are diagnosed with sickle cell disease. One in 13 carry the trait.
If you look at the map for where malaria is and the map of where sickle cell trait is, they really overlap. And so that protective effect is really what kind of puts it there and in the Mediterranean and other places in that region.
The new treatment, crisanlizumab, reduces the ability of red blood cells to stick to blood vessel walls, which can cause fatal blood clots. The 52-week-long trial provided patients with either a high dose of the trial drug, a low dose of the trial drug, or a placebo. The results exceeded expectations.
Almost 50% of people who were on active drug in the highest dose did not have a crisis compared to the placebo group. And there were actually 24 people in the highest dose of the drug that had no admissions, no crisis during that 1 year period.
Lyle says this study signals a new era for sickle cell research and greater hope for those living with the disease.
If you take someone that has two or three crises per year and you can completely prevent it, you've saved yourselves several weeks of hospitalization out of that year. You know, sickle cell crisis has a heavy disease burden. So financially, if the insurance company doesn't have to pay for an admission where you're, you know, spending $500 a day on the hospital bed and all the medicines and IVs and everything else, it's thousands of dollars to society and to the patient.
Because the pain felt by sickle cell patients can be hard to predict, Lyle says the results of the study could be recorded in retrospect. Patients like Majara Mooring realized they hadn't been to the hospital as often as they used to.
After the trial was over, my doctor, which is Dr. Lyles, talked to me. We sat down and talked. She was like, "Well, how you been feeling?" I was like, "I'm fine." She's like, "Well, we haven't been in the hospital." I said, "You know what? Sitting here thinking about that, you're right."
The pain didn't go away completely, Mooring said, but through previously prescribed medication and coping techniques developed over a lifetime, she was able to take care of herself and avoid visits to the ER.
I do hope this is a cure. This is the beginning of helping not only me, but other adults and kids that are out there suffering with sickle cell disease.
Lyle says those hospital visits can be long and excruciating.
I think that one of the problems that the patients perceive is when they have one of these crises, they come into the emergency room and people say, "Well, you know, your arm's not broken, you're not bleeding anywhere, I can't see your pain."
Lyles and Mooring hope this new treatment brings increased awareness to sickle cell disease, which impacts communities that continue to fight for recognition, though the ailments aren't always visible. I'm Chris Thomas.
Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the New Bern Preservation Foundation's Antique Show and Sale, taking place next week, February 10th through the 12th. The weekend event features more than 35 dealers, and ticket holders can bring up to 3 items for appraisal, noon until 3 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Lee Purcell, co-chair of the Antique Show and Sale.
How many people are you expecting for this year's Antique Show and Sale, and do you have collectors drive from all over eastern North Carolina or even the state to come to this show?
We have collectors, Mac, coming from several states, as well as our dealers who come from as far as Florida and New Jersey. To answer the first part of your question, the weather always has a big role in events such as ours. We expect 1,200, 1,300. We really hope, if all conditions break our way, to make 1,500 ticket sales, and that would be really a special event.
This year, more than 35 dealers from up and down the East Coast will be attending the event next weekend. Now, what types of antiques and collectibles will they be bringing?
They're bringing antique furniture from the 19th century. They will be bringing military items. They will be bringing sterling silverware, estate jewelry, more modern jewelry, books, antique documents. We have someone coming who is bringing deeds, citations, autographs, things like that that you don't see every day. We have a really interesting guy from Jacksonville, North Carolina. The name of his business is When Radio Was King, and he finds classic old phonographs and telephones, the type of things that your grandparents would have been comfortable with, names like Crosley, Dumont, and Zenith. Lovely pieces of wooden furniture, and he rebuilds the insides of them so that the end product is a fantastic looking piece of furniture for a table or on your floor, and the inside, the guts of it, the music comes out sounding just the way you would expect it nowadays.
As part of this event, ticket holders can bring three items to be appraised by experts. Now, how is this going to work?
We have two certified appraisers, and the certification is a very important criteria. Will Gorgeous from New Bern and Tom Falconberry of Tom's Coins on Middle Street in New Bern. Both of these gentlemen have years of experience in appraising and dealing with coins, with furniture, with military items, with flags, with more materials and subjects than I can even start to relate to you. They will be there on Saturday and Sunday from noon until 3.
What are some of the more unusual or maybe rare items you've seen in the past shows?
That's a really good question. I have seen really lovely military pistols and swords. I have seen carpets, the likes of which I've never seen before. You might call them Oriental or Persian. I have seen pitchers and plates made out of pewter, vintage toys, the type that 100 years ago kids would have had that are made of metal or copper, and wheels that roll around on the floor, the type that you just don't see. And once you see them on a dealer's shelf, it stops me in my tracks, and I want to look at it, and I want to touch it, and bring it home for a grandkid or someone like that who has never in his lifetime seen something special like this.
I want to ask you about your flyer for the antique show and sale. Now, it's a picture of a mysterious woman wearing red lipstick and sunglasses. She's holding a red purse. Now, how does she play into the theme of this antique show?
Some people say in it they see Marilyn Monroe. Other people say a combination between Lady Gaga and Madonna. Other younger people will see a younger Gwen Stefani, I think. We were looking this time around to have an eye-catching image, preferably of a woman in a strong, vibrant red color that just grabs your eyes as you walk by and make you want to look further into what is this? Why is this woman here on a poster?
Profits from this event will go to support New Bern Preservation Foundation, which has helped save over 60 structures in New Bern. And you're currently working on renovating the Union Station Depot, I understand. How's that project coming along?
Well, it's all of a sudden, after several years of being in limbo and serious negotiations and palavering, we're going to have a lot of really good news at the show to share with our neighbors and citizens who've been watching the depot for years and saying, when's it going to come back to life? Well, this is the year when we're going to be taking some big steps for that to happen. Ticket holders who come into the show will have a big booth table set up with a model of the depot. Surrounding the model will be some trams set up by the Carolina Coastal Railroaders Group. That should be stopping people in their tracks. And we think it's a good tie-in because they've been good partners and supporters of us in trying to save the depot for years now.
Lee Purcell is the co-chair of the New Bern Antique Show and Sale. Thanks for being here today.
I thank you.
The antique show and sale takes place February 10th through the 12th at the Dearborn Riverfront Convention Center. And for more information on this Public Radio East media-sponsored event, go to the ENC events calendar, publicradioeast.org.
I'm Mary Jo Heath. Join me for Verdi's timeless tragedy, Rigoletto, broadcast live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House. Baritone Jelko Lucic is Rigoletto, who cannot protect his beloved daughter from his own corrupt world. Soprano Olga Peritiatko sings the role of the innocent Gilda. And tenor Stephen Costello is the lustful Duke, who is as seductive as he is powerful. Maestro Pier Giorgio Morandi conducts Verdi's irresistible score. During intermission, we'll bring you backstage interviews plus the opera quiz. Don't miss Rigoletto, Saturday, live on the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera International Radio Network.
The opera Saturday afternoon at 1 on PRE, Public Radio East Classical.
Today on the Garden Journal, we speak with Horticulture Extension Agent for Onslow County, Lisa Rayburn, about incubator farms. It's an emerging trend across the nation and here in eastern North Carolina, helping cultivate a new generation of farmers to grow fresh local produce. Lisa, thanks for joining us today by phone. Can you explain exactly what is an incubator farm and how do they work?
Yeah, so when we look at the challenges that face people who want to get into farming, they typically have two main challenges. Historically, people would have gotten into farming because their family also farmed. And so being part of a farm family would have both given them the experience that they needed to farm as well as the access to land. And so with an incubator farm, what we're trying to do is overcome those two challenges. We provide people with the technical expertise to learn how to farm, but we also provide them with access to land so that they can get their business operation up and started, get a business plan developed before they have to spin out and try to find farmland on their own.
Are there incubator farms already up and running in Onslow County?
So in Onslow County, we have an incubator farm that is a joint effort between Onslow County Cooperative Extension and the Onslow County Farmers Market, and that is here in Jacksonville, adjacent to the Extension office and the Farmers Market, and this project has been in the work for a couple of years.
So what kinds of crops do you grow?
Our program focuses largely on vegetable production, so we grow a wide range of both cool and warm season vegetables.
And farming, of course, is hard work, not to mention our weather here in eastern North Carolina. Of course, we deal with flooding and drought, below freezing temperatures, so on. Do you think that there's just too much risk involved in farming? Is that why there's maybe a push for new farmers?
So certainly there is a lot of risk in farming, but there's room for success in farming as well. If you're passionate about it and you really find your niche, there's certainly room for people to be successful. But nobody who's involved with farming is going to tell you that there is not risk involved. There is a lot of risk.
According to the Center for Environmental Farming Systems, the average age of North Carolina's farmers is 57 years old. Are you hoping to maybe inspire the younger generation to become interested in farming with trying to do incubator farms?
Absolutely. I mean, the primary goal of the incubator farm program is to help people get into farming and be successful in farming so that we have people coming along to fill the shoes of those farmers who are starting to age out of the workforce.
And not to mention fresh local vegetables and fruits.
Absolutely. We've seen a lot of increased demand in the last couple of years as people are becoming more interested in knowing where their food comes from and sourcing their food locally. We would like to have the growers here available to meet that demand.
So, say somebody listening to this report is interested in farming and getting involved with the incubation program. How would they do that?
Here in Onslow County, they can contact the Onslow County Cooperative Extension Office at 910-455-5873. And we can discuss what people are interested in and where they're looking to go and whether they would like to be a participant in our incubator farm program for listeners in other parts of our listening area, I would encourage them to contact their local cooperative extension office. Each county will have an agent who helps people, either existing farmers or people who are interested in getting into farming, and they'll make you aware of whatever resources are closest to you.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jared. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at our website, publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.